Good morning, good evening, everyone. A huge welcome to the third session in Armstrong Wolf's first ever mental health series. Today we have one of our very own COOs from the community, Mr. Peter Gibbonson, COO of Standard Chartered Bank. And Peter will be joined by Claire Sparks, HR, also Standard Chartered. And we'll be discussing how do we support and actually retain engagement when the second and third degrees of contact are lost. How do we recreate those little breakout sessions, the water cooler chats, whilst working within a dislocated workforce model? But also, Peter will also detail his own journey. We've actually had a great week so far with Emma from Mental Health First Aid England. She gave us lots of resources on coping with stress on Monday. And yesterday we had our women COO community, and they had an amazing panel, a discussion around managing the well-being of staff for better productivity and retention. Tomorrow, we have a TEDx speaker, ex-senior vice president for Unilever and co-founder of Mind at Work, an incredible charity, Jeff McDonald. And Jeff will dive into the critical nature of having the well-being of staff at the very heart of any organization and why it needs to be a strategic priority. And Friday, we see Mental Health First Aid England return. And this time, there will be with the CEO, Mr. Simon Blake, OBE, addressing leading with authenticity and compassion. Overall, the aim of this week is to really, if it's such a word, destigmatize mental health in financial services. Have coping mechanisms at hand. Make your mental health a priority. And really, it's put on your own oxygen mask first before you help others. Then you're going to be in a much better place to help them when you're on solid ground. So listening is one part and a critical part, but it must be backed by action. Get the processes in place to facilitate and not block. If you are a leader, be proud of how you lead. And for all of us, have the boundaries in place so we know when our mental health is actually being compromised. And openly communicate that with our family and friends so they know exactly where you're at. My name is Miriam Rooney. I am Chief of Staff and Global Client Director for Armstrong Wolf's International CEO Community. There's probably a lot of you who don't quite not quite so familiar with us. And we are an advisory firm to the chief operating officers in the financial services industry. And we aim to empower the CEO community through the provision of thought leadership, share experiences, and provide a platform to promote really rich cross-industry dialogue. I've only just recently joined Armstrong Wolf, and I've come from a transformational coaching background where I worked almost exclusively with C-suite individuals. And I have seen firsthand what it means to ignore our mental health, the devastating impact this can have. So I am thrilled that we are hosting this timely series and highlighting mental health, particularly within financial services. Today, the session will be slightly different format to our normal webinar due to the large numbers in attendance. So we'd ask you to please use the chat function throughout the session, and we'll answer as many questions at the end in the Q&A session. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Peter Gibbonson. Peter is COO, Frontline Monitoring Standard Chartered, and we're very proud to say he is one of our very own COO community. Peter is also chair to two wellbeing committees, UK and Financial Markets, and he is passionate about breaking down the stigma around mental health. Peter, over to you. How to support and retain engagement when second and third degrees of contact are lost?
Thank you very much. Thank you for that introduction. Thank you, everyone. So I'm going to give... Well, first of all, if there are any questions along the way, please feel free to ask them. And I'm going to talk about separation and how those degrees of contact are being lost and how that impacts us, how that impacts our mental health and how it impacts us more widely. But if we go off at different tangents and people have got different questions they want to ask, please do. This is a nice group of us that we can discuss things as and when we go along and that we think are relevant. So it will take whichever direction it wants to take. I think it's useful for me, first of all, to sort of quickly talk about my journey and my experience and why I'm here and why I'm involved with two wellbeing committees and why I'm a mental health first aider at work and why it's so important to me. So I've suffered with mental health issues myself from a very early age. I guess I was about 9 or 10 years old, and I was aware that I wasn't well. I was aware that something was wrong. I guess I would have classed it as being very, very unhappy, but it was desperately unhappy, and it would have been seen as depression now, but you know, we're talking back the end of the 70s, the early 80s, when mental health wasn't talked about really at all. I remember people talking about, you know, someone suffers with their nerves. People didn't even like to talk about depression and talk about and use that word. But, you know, depression in children was barely recognized then, and certainly not recognized by my parents, and certainly not something that I could articulate. I wasn't old enough to really express myself properly and to be able to explain what I was suffering from. I then went through my teenage years, obviously usual teenage angst most of us have, quite difficult teenage years, onto university, and you create your own coping mechanisms. And in fairness for me, alcohol would sometimes be a coping mechanism. Self-medication with mental health issues is quite common. And alcohol was one of mine, especially when I was younger. I then started working in financial services, in banking, became a trader. So I joined the markets in 1993. I feel old now when I had people join the bank and they're born after I started work. So that always makes me feel really old, but there you go. So I was very busy with work, but I guess around my early 30s, I hit a real crisis. I guess you'd even call it probably a form of breakdown. And I was at the stage I had to get help. I had to go and get professional help. I had to go and speak to someone. I saw a psychiatrist and a psychologist at the time. I went on medication for the first time. And I remember, and this is one of the reasons why, I always tell this story, but I think it's important. I remember at the time I went to my boss and I said, look, I've been diagnosed with clinical depression. They want me to have some time off. I don't want to have time off. And my boss's first reaction was, well, I think you're working in the wrong industry then. And not particularly empathetic. He wasn't a particularly empathetic individual, in fairness, and there's no shortage of that in financial services. I got help. I put my hands up and realised that I couldn't cope on my own. I was really at a really quite serious crisis point then. And then coming to full circle, joining Standard Chartered Bank 14, 15 years ago, worked abroad for a while, and then came back to the UK about 7.5 years ago. And I decided that, you know, I really wanted to get involved in the mental health work that was happening. I think the UK in Standard Chartered doing some great work. I joined the wellbeing committee in the UK. And one of my first ideas was I thought we should have mental health first aiders. I'd read about it. I'd read about companies that had mental health first aiders. And it was quite a new concept back then. And we agreed we thought it was a great idea. I was one of the first cohort of 20 or so. I did a two-day course, the two-day Mental Health First Aid England course. And it helped me understand not just more about mental health and mental health challenges, but it helped me understand more about myself as well. So I found that really, really valuable. And that's just gone from strength to strength. And I think as a credit to the UK Wellbeing Committee, it's now HR policy now. There has to be a certain number of mental health first aiders. So I think that's a great thing. I hope we reach a stage as a society, we don't think about mental health and physical health as being separate. A, they're interlinked, and B, it's all about just our overall health. So I'm passionate about breaking those stigmas down. I did the This Is Me videos, which were under the Lord Mayor's appeal. I talked about my depression and my history. And I think it's more and more important that those of us in financial services, more and more seniors in financial services, talk about their challenges, because that's the best way to break the stigmas down for people to say, look, I understand because I've suffered and I've experienced X, Y, Z. So on to the topic in hand today, and talking about how we support and retain engagement when second and third degrees of contact are lost. So I guess the first thing I want to say is that I think COVID-19 and the circumstances in which you've created the working from home environment have had quite significant mental health effects on people. And I think there's two pieces to that. I think people like myself who've had mental health issues before, I've definitely noticed times when I've really struggled. I've really struggled with working from home. I've really struggled with the demarcation between work and home life, and being able to separate work out from home. And it's certainly at times exacerbated my own issues and my own challenges. But also I think for people who've maybe never had significant mental health issues in the past, I think it's created issues which haven't been there before. Discussions earlier on, I think we're in the midst of almost a mental health epidemic because COVID has created a very, very unusual situation in that it's created a lot of uncertainty, but that lack of social interaction and social contact that, as humans we strive for, got broken down for long periods of time. And I think that's really had a lot of effect in terms of people's loneliness, isolation. You know, if you're a young person living in a one bed flat and, during the first lockdown, you could barely leave the property. And, it must have been desperate times for some people, desperate for how they cope with that. So now I'm going to go and ask you on the chat a question about. So I'm going to talk about a mental health survey. I think this is a Mental Health England survey with a few statistics. So in terms of people on the chat, who has found working from home has improved their well-being, and who's found that it's worsened their well-being?
I think that's a great question, isn't it? I think it's more living at work, isn't it? It's become, the hours, we need to have the boundaries in place, and I think so few people have, because you end up picking up the laptop, going into the room when you should be spending having family time, and it's just, as you said, the demarcation just isn't there anymore.
Yeah.
Can't just walk out and leave your computer and then the desk at work and walk away from it. It's just not, it's not there. So we have
there we go.
Yeah. Horrific with homeschooling. Well, that's absolutely one of the ones, and that's ongoing, because you know. And also, you're a teacher, you're the taxi driver, you're feeding them all while you're supposed to be doing a day's work. It's very difficult.
Okay, it's good. Nice to see some improvement here.
Yeah, absolutely. Reassessing priorities, that's good.
Yeah.
I'd like to know a bit more about that, reassessing. So what have you reassessed? What have you put as a priority now that wasn't a priority before? Yes, I think the flexibility is something that's going to be, for when they return to office, I think that's something that's going to have to be offered. It has to be taken into account. So people enjoyed working from home and said, yeah, I like working from home, but actually, I want a little bit of office time as well, so you can keep up that human contact. And also, the offices, you need those moments to problem solve. You need those little breakout sessions to, you can solve something in 10 minutes. It's something that's in your head and you're letting it fester. Just to have that 10 minute, 5 days a week. Yeah, so that's good. I mean, that's great feedback. So it mostly has improved apart from the homeschooling.
So homeschooling as well. Yeah, I think as a parent, to be a teacher my father was a teacher actually. But as a parent, being a teacher, although he never taught us, he always thought that teaching your own children was a bad idea, and he was right, because being a parent and being a teacher, there's different skills. And actually what I hope, one of the good things that's come out of COVID-19, as well as us obviously appreciating the health and emergency services and what an amazing thing to do, I hope people do appreciate what an amazing job teachers do, because it's, good teachers are amazing. And I think what they do, I think a lot of parents are like, wow, do you know what? You could have them. You do a great job. Thank you. So in terms of this survey, so it's not hugely dissimilar. So from this mental health survey, 45% of people said working from home was better for their well-being, 29% worse, and the difference being the same. The one thing to note on that, though, the caveat was that working from home for for COVID-19 reasons versus people who've worked from home previously before COVID-19 was on the scene. Has that the impacts that this mental health survey commented on was 67% were less connected, 46% had less exercise, 37% had disturbed sleep. And I think there's a difference between working from home by choice, a lot of institutions are moving to that as we go forwards and we come out of COVID-19, and working from home and being isolated when you don't have the choice and it's not optional, and when you lose that human contact. I guess one other one for people here to put have a guess at, what percentage of people don't want to go back to the office full time? This is based on that survey again. Just put your percentage number of people that don't want to go back to the office full time. So they want to work from home, at least some of the time.
I wouldn't think it was that high. I think most people want some degree of contact. So I would probably about 20% maybe would want to stay at home.
Well, this is at least part of the time.
Yeah. Oh, at least part of the time. Okay.
Part of the time. So what percentage do people think don't want to go back to the office full time? We've got 45%. Any?
I'd say more. Yeah, I'd say it's probably
70 from David.
60%.
80.
Yeah.
We've got some close ones here.
So it's probably even higher than 80.
No, it's 75% actually.
Okay.
So, 75% of people don't want to go back to the office full time, which means a quarter of people are quite happy to work full time in the office. And then the second thing, and I did touch on it earlier, about what's I think important to note is that we are social creatures, human beings. We're hierarchical. We're social creatures, and I think the challenge for me for working from home, and I think this has been evidenced again from a lot of conversations with people, is that that human contact is about tactile creatures. So whether it's a touch on the arm, we are tactile, obviously within boundaries, but we're tactile as human beings. And that tactile nature is important. But also we pick up body language clues all the time when we're talking to people, when we're in meetings, and you won't even realize you're picking it up, but you lose some of that. You certainly lose that over the phone and over email. Very easy to misinterpret an email, far harder to misinterpret someone speaking face to face and seeing how they're reacting and how they're interacting with you.
Sure.
Sound like an accusation over email. Face to face is a simple question and you see the intention of it. So I think the pandemic really for me has reinforced how we're social creatures, how important that social interaction is, and work for a lot of us is one of our main social interactions.
Mm-hmm.
It's a framework for us and it's interaction with like-minded people a lot of the time, so I wouldn't say it's a social club, but it has a degree of that to it. And there are, you know, some of my favourite moments are grabbing coffees with people or going and having lunch with someone and chatting to them. And I think that's much easier in a work environment and you have that on a much more sort of systematic basis.
I think
important in terms of... Sorry, Miriam, did you want to say something?
No, I was just going to say, when everyone's on, it would be good to ask them, how did they cope with this? Or what were the issues from working from home? What were the, in terms of the second and third lines of degrees of contact?
Yeah.
Which areas were they struggling with? And then we can go through those. If they could just put the chat. Yeah. What bits did they miss most in terms of contact? Sorry, Peter, go ahead then.
So, yeah, we could do that. I've actually got some ideas for people. I've got a list of ideas. Some of the things we've done at StandChart, some of the things I've thought of and looked into. So I think it's important, especially during COVID-19, but in terms of working from home more generally, I think it's especially important though during COVID-19 in terms of communication. I think that both officially, line managers, the wider company, Standard Chartered, it's really important that communicate often, over communicate. I think it's also important to communicate with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Have doubts, when we have questions, when we have concerns, and not let things fester and not sit there. One of my great traits, well, negative traits, is I ruminate on things. So something bothers me, I'll ruminate on it for days, when really I should be saying to someone, hang on, I'm a bit bothered by this, or I don't really understand that, and I should have that discussion. And then, you know, you don't have the situation where you're bothered and you ruminate on things. You know, I think we have a structure of 30-minute one-to-ones as an institution. Generally with our line managers, maybe that's every 2 weeks, every month. I don't think that's enough. I think we need more interaction and more interaction on an ad hoc basis. I think the other thing that's very important is that I think we need, I think all companies need access to mental health support. So in Standard Chartered, we've got the Employee Assistant Program. We've got mental health first aiders. We've got mental health toolkits on our intraweb. We've got workplace healthcare, where people can access psychologists, etc. Or if it's more serious, can see a psychiatrist. So I think it's really important that that access to mental health support is there. I think it's also important for companies to, and when I was thinking about this, I changed the word actually a little, develop a culture that encourages work-life separation. I wonder whether we should actually enforce work-life separation. So I know with Goldman's, there was the, you know, no emails after 10 p.m. on a Friday or until midday Saturday, which, you know, a lot of people were laughing at. You know, they get kind of half a day off. But actually, maybe we should have a, some companies have a Zoom-free Friday. We use BlueJeans, but have a Zoom-free Friday. Maybe we have a, you know, everyone in banking has to do a 2-week block leave. We allow people to look at emails, reply to emails, but not take any significant decisions. Maybe we should just block people's emails for 2 weeks. You're not going to get any emails because we're going to block the server.
Yeah. I
love that, because there's no incentive or encouragement for me to look at them if I'm not receiving them. And there's no chance for anyone to ever think, oh, my manager will feel badly about me. I'm off for 2 weeks. I've not dealt with something. Because if you block them, you block them. So I wonder whether we need to have some way to enforce that work-life separation. And then the final thing, and I think this is very important, not just in terms of working from home and COVID-19, but I also think more generally, but it is very important specifically to the current situation, is I think managers and leadership need to show humility, but they need to show vulnerability as well. I think it's really honest that managers are honest with their staff, are honest about their own challenges, and they also ask the right questions. We're very transactional in a banking COO environment. But maybe sometimes the right question to ask first off is, how are you? How are you doing? And to actually wait and to listen to the answer.
Mm-hmm.
We'll do that. How are you? And they go straight into it. And what they're really saying is, I'm expected to say, how are you? But I'm not really interested in what you say. But, you know, I think it's more important than ever that line managers are tuned in and they ask those questions, because you'll be amazed how many times you'll say to someone, how are you doing? How are you? And if you wait, people will open up and actually say, do you know what? Actually, I'm not so great. Struggling at home. Kids have been a bit of a nightmare. And it's amazing how people will open up and you'll have a better understanding. But it doesn't just have to be as a line manager. It can also be with colleagues and friends. I think we should use that technique with loved ones and friends as well. Not be scared to ask, how are you? Not be scared to wait for the answers and to listen. One of the things you learn as a mental health first aid, and we've done Samaritan's training in the bank as well, I think it's really important. I think it's really important to listen. So then some specific ideas. So these are kind of a little bit more specific, and I ran through a few things that we're doing as a bank, and then I think that other institutions are doing. I'm not sure how well all of them work. I think with this as well, you've got to not be scared to experiment. You've got to not be scared to try things and find they might not work, or they might not work for your group of people, or might not work for your team. We have town halls quite regularly at work. We have a system called Pigeonhole, where people can ask questions. What I like about pigeonholing our bank when people ask questions is that you can ask questions anonymously. And some people don't like that because they think some of the questions have been a bit passive aggressive. And I can see that. But actually, I think you're going to get very honest questions when people are anonymous, and people are going to ask the really pertinent, difficult questions. And if there's some questions you don't like, so be it, is my view. Mm-hmm. I think it's important that we get our start, because you find otherwise, my view is, in a group, and especially in a big group, people don't want to be challenging generally. They don't want to ask difficult, challenging questions. They don't want to challenge senior individuals. They don't want to challenge the strategy of the bank, for instance. And I think they're important. They're important for all of those things to happen. 30-minute walk and talk. So I've not done this, but I read of this recently where the suggestion is, when you have a meeting with your team, have it away from the desk. Say, right, everyone, put yourself on a headset or on your phone, and we're going to walk and talk. So the meeting's going to be for 30 minutes, but none of us are sitting at our desk. So you get exercise, and you get a fresher, and you look at things differently by being outdoors. Reimagine commuting time. So set aside time for coffee or chats, perhaps. So if your commute's an hour in the morning, maybe set that time aside and say, right, I'm going to have that hour as a virtual commute, when I might have a 20-minute coffee with someone, and I might have 20 minutes reading the online paper, 30 minutes reading the online paper, which I would do on my normal commute, and not think I'm at my desk, I must be doing work. Think I'm sitting down, actually, and I'm going to use that as a virtual commute. I actually really like that idea.
That's a great idea. I haven't heard that.
Yeah, and I think that really works, because actually I used to love reading the paper on the way in and on the way home, and I don't get to do that so much now. And it's nice, because one of the things commuting does is it does break your day down. It does separate your day out. There's actually something called, it was meant as a joke, but actually they think it's true now, called Parkinson's Law. And Parkinson's Law is that your work will expand to fill the time you have in your working day. So if you've got a working day in the office, or a 10-hour working day in the office, your work will fill that. So one of the problems with working from home is your day doesn't really have a start or end. And this is why so many people are working till 10, 11 o'clock at night, because of this Parkinson's Law. Your work has expanded to fill the time available. And I thought to myself, that's actually a really good explanation, I think, of what's happening, because we hear that a lot in our bank, that people are working longer hours than ever. And is it because we're less efficient? Is it because it's different working from home? I mean, actually, working from home, there's less distractions. So I don't know what the answer is. But and that's why I was talking about the enforcing the work-life balance. I think, as more and more people work from home and work from home on a more regular basis, I think companies are going to have to think about how that works. Talking about email blocks, yeah.
Yeah, that's good, actually. It's quite a good point, isn't it? The concern is that the potential removes the ability to be flexible. So if you want to log on the weekend before you come back into work and clear some, so you don't have that crazy Monday morning. So maybe it's there's a mind to either side of it. Maybe there's a... you get eased into it. And
yeah, but I sometimes think emails are like social media. They can be a bit addictive.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree.
Off, it's difficult to turn off from it.
Yeah.
And I guess you should always have the situation, you can be phoned if it's an emergency, and that's fine. But generally things aren't emergencies, and generally the wheels keep turning, and generally things can work, wait 2 weeks if you're on leave.
Yeah.
Then Pomodoro technique. Pomodoro is a tomato timer, and it needs to be a tomato timer, a Pomodoro timer. Don't ask me why. That's very important. And you set that first of all, you can set that for breaks. It's recommended you set that at 55 minutes, and then you have a 5-minute break every 55 minutes. You could, however, use it and say every 2 hours, set a 15-minute timer, that's when you're going to connect with people. That's when you're going to grab a few people you wouldn't normally talk to, maybe outside of your team, and have a little chat to them. So that's a chance to connect with someone. And I think it's the visual side of it being the tomato timer that makes it. And I don't know, but apparently it's very important. It's a tomato timer. So
has to be Pomodoro.
Yes. I think it's important to avoid email tennis. I think chats are okay. I think video conferencing is better. And then some companies have had team video, but not for any meeting, just like team video. So you can see people that are there and working, and you just feel that sense of inclusivity and sense of a group. Talked about it in terms of the commuting, but also to have virtual coffee mornings, virtual lunches, make them informal, make them not about work. Have it bring in your pets, sit down, you know, have your dog on your lap or have your kids come in the room, and, you know, make it not about work. Have an hour meeting when you're just chatting about life and how you're getting on and what you're doing and what your plans are and what are your first things you're going to do when lockdown's over and what's the first restaurant you want to go to and et cetera.
Exactly.
That's a good way to connect. And I think in terms of that as well, and something I've tried to do now, and I didn't initially, is to have an open door policy. So my boy has just turned 7 a couple of days ago. And my view is he can come in anytime. Sometimes I'll say I'm busy or is it important? And I say, I'll come back to you. But I also want him to be able to come in whenever he wants. And I think that's good. I think one of the good things that's come out is people have been much more sort of open about their families. And I think it's, I think where this came up, and actually there was a load of positive feedback about it. I think there was someone who was being interviewed for a news story and his kid came in during the, when he was being interviewed for the news story.
Yes.
And I think it's lovely, actually. And I think that's, you know, that's all about being human as well. That's all about showing our human side. Talked about mental health first aiders. This is something we don't do, but again, another idea, having a buddy system. So someone can pair up, almost a little bit like, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, when you have a sponsor. It's kind of like a work sponsor, someone you can go to when you're struggling or just someone you want to connect with and talk about things when they're not so great or you're worried about things. So some kind of buddy system. Not sure how that would work. And we do have mental health first aiders, but sort of slightly less formal buddy system when people can reach out to someone and they know there's someone there. And maybe it's vice versa. It's a two-way thing with the buddy system.
And Peter, are people really easy about approaching the mental health first aiders? Is it an easy process in terms of, are people still reluctant to get involved?
So I used to see about a person every couple of weeks historically when I was in the office.
Yeah.
I see that now. I think it's much harder for, I think it's much harder for people. Yeah, I think it's much harder for people to do that.
Is there still a fear involved surrounding it?
I guess the problem is, I guess people think if they do it when they're working from home, I guess there's a concern. They think it's almost like a formal channel and they're reaching out to someone on a formal channel. And I know historically a lot of my, you know, for various degrees of seriousness, when people have come to me as a mental health first aider, and I'm quite well known in the bank and talked about my mental health. So I think it makes it sometimes easier for people to talk to me, because they know I can, you know, hopefully I can relate. It's often been people just come up to me and say, can I grab a quick coffee? Have you got 10 minutes now? I just want to have a quick chat. And they often don't say what they want to talk to me about, but we'll grab a coffee and then they'll want to talk about something mental health wise or something mental health in their family that they want to discuss. So I think that's been harder with working from home. It's not just that, actually, we have a speaking up policy in the bank, and there's been less people speaking up during working from home and during this. Now, it could be, you know, I guess a lot of speaking ups historically can be about harassment and such like, and maybe there's less of that happens when we're working from home. But I definitely think people are a little bit nervous about contacting someone officially because they think there's a record of it. Anyway, that's me surmising, but that's kind of my feeling.
Yeah, well, Steve has just messaged in and said, I find that being open encourages openness, so people talk to me, but don't want to tell their line manager or even see professional help because of the stigma.
Yeah.
That's what I'm addressing.
And we talked about mental health on a town hall, and one made the comment about, well, what if my boss doesn't understand or he just won't listen to me. And I made the point, I said, I don't think it's optional anymore. I don't think it's optional for our seniors and our people managers not anymore. I think they have to. I think just as it's not acceptable to be sexist or racist, it's not acceptable to not be engaged and be open to mental health changes people have. I just don't think it's acceptable anymore. Trello. We use Trello as a system to manage timelines and projects, work in sprints. It's a good chance for our team. We get together, talk about our work. We do what's called a retro. We go through what went well, what went badly. It's a good system. I think people were a bit cynical about it at first, but actually it works really well. It's a really good system. Water cooler channel. We've talked about that at work, but I haven't had it yet. Somewhere you can just drop by again. I don't know how that works. Might be one of those that sounds a better idea than it is in reality. That's been tested. And then things like quiz nights, online games, online events. Again, that's a bit like the informal, but it's something I think people often like quiz nights and those sort of things. So how do we have more of them? How do we arrange them? That's a way to connect people, different bits of the business that maybe don't normally interact with each other. And then the final thing, and after this, I get Claire to jump in. Hopefully Claire's on the call. I get her to jump in and add anything she wants to add about how we stay connected in these difficult times. I think it's really important to not forget to laugh together. I think laughter is so important.
Yeah.
I was on a call yesterday with the COO management team and something came. I think I said bonjour to everyone as I came on and someone said, oh, you sound like Del Boy. And then I told a trigger story, one of the trigger jokes that I'd seen recently, which had me in fits of laughter, and we were all laughing about it. And I think it's really important that sometimes we just don't take ourselves seriously, don't take work so seriously, and we don't forget to laugh.
Do you think all of this will have an effect on the talent retention, particularly the newcomers, if they're not getting the water chiller moments where they're, you know, have a 10-minute chat with somebody, have a quick coffee? Do you think we could be losing good people?
I think we could. I think it's more than that. Actually, there were some surveys done, and I think 90%, 89% of millennials said that they didn't want to work for a company where mental health and well-being wasn't a key agenda item. Mm. So I don't think it's optional for companies. I think it's the right thing to do anyway. I think thinking about people's mental health and how we can help people as much as possible is the right thing to do regardless. But actually, it's good business because it's how you retain people and how you keep people. But I do think it's difficult if you've joined during lockdown into a company and you've never been in the office and you've never met your team physically. I can imagine it being very challenging, no doubt about it. And I don't think there's an easy way to get around that, apart from trying to have as many sessions and video sessions together as a group as you can, and then to say we'll eventually all be meeting up when we can. And I think, you know, I think physically meeting up is important, and to give people that hope, because I think that's the kind of word I use a lot now, and I think it's important. It's about hope, because there is a light at the end of the tunnel. We are coming out of this. Things are easing off, and I'm very optimistic about the future. I'm very optimistic that we've been through something that, you know, that people will talk about in 30 years' time, 40 years' time. My little boy, this is the most significant thing's happened in his life. Mm-hmm. It's a lot. And to me, it's like the falling of the Berlin Wall or 9/11. These are all things that are seared in my memory. And I think COVID, how it happened, and lockdowns, and especially the first lockdown when there was so much more uncertainty about maybe how serious it was. And it's very serious, but we didn't know if it was even more serious back then. I think that will be seared into our synapses forever.
Yeah. I think we have to look at find a silver lining.
I think there is a silver lining. I think it will teach us to, where someone talked about reprioritizing. I think it will teach us to think about reprioritizing. What was a, and again, there was a nurse, and she was interviewed about end of life care, and she told some wonderful stories about people at the end of their life and about palliative care. And she said, the number of times people would say, I wish I hadn't worked so hard. I wish I'd spent more time with my family. I wish I'd had more time for myself. No one ever at the end says, I wish I'd worked more. So I think, and I think that's an important one, again, talking about that work-life balance. And now, trust me, I'm the worst, physician heal thyself, for taking that advice. But I think it's really important.
And maybe we will look back at this time, even the, you know, the challenges of homeschooling, we will look back in years to come and see the joy that there was in that. And, you know, and it was something we didn't necessarily want to do, but it's forced upon us families and contacts, and actually probably created much stronger bonds.
Yeah. And I hope people really, I mean, you know, I've got friends that are doctors and nurses, and I think they're angels. And I think that,
really,
and I think hopefully all of us really appreciate that more and appreciate the work they do. And as I said, the teachers as well, but also the delivery drivers and the supermarket, you know, this could have been very different. If this had been more serious than even it was, if this had been a 20% fatality rate, say, or something devastating, society could have collapsed. You know, it might have been that there were no supermarkets, that they wouldn't have been open. So I think this should be a wake-up call as well. I think the silver lining should be that all of humanity should take a wake-up and say, look, this is your warning shot, because it is going to happen again. And next time it might be more serious. Now, that next time might be a year, it might be 30 years, it might be 50 years, but it is going to happen again. And there will be another disease, and there will be something that will probably be more devastating than COVID-19. So let's make sure we learn the lessons, because if we don't learn the lessons of the past, then we're destined to repeat the mistakes. So I think that's really important.
Yeah, I think it's definitely brought humanity back into it. There's so many beautiful stories, and also how much we need. How many people have missed just being hugged? Forgive me, but hiding behind a mask and no contact with anyone outside your own immediate family has just been so tough, really tough on people. And I think it's really highlighted what we are as humans and how much we need to belong, we need to connect, and we need to physically, as you said, that there's a tactile element to it.
But I think you're right, especially with younger children. I was thinking about this recently, about masks, talking about body language. Babies pick up, toddlers and babies pick up a lot from facial expressions without even realizing it, obviously. But they pick up from facial expressions, and they've lost that. A lot of that's been lost, especially when people are out, and that's much harder. And they're talking about as well, people who have hearing issues and lip read. It's been terrible. Mm. Really difficult for them. I asked Claire to come along.
I am here. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Welcome, Claire.
Sorry, I've rambled on. Wondered if you had anything else to say before.
You've spoken, Pete, and you've picked up virtually every idea I've ever had, so I really don't think I've got a great deal to add. The things that I would reinforce, probably three points. The walk and talks, I think, are really, really valuable. We spend so much time staring at each other on video conference, and most of the time you don't need to be able to see that person. You don't need access to spreadsheets or documents or whatever. And I think Pete made the point during the earlier conversation that we are getting less exercise by virtue of the fact that we're not commuting, and physical health and mental health obviously are so intrinsically linked, that it's really important to get out of the four wall syndrome and get some exercise, to take a walk when you can. Even people listening to a call like this, you know, everybody should be out walking, really and truly, because they don't need to be looking at their screen while a call like this is on. I have always been dreadfully bad at needing to respond to things the minute they come in, even if it was a Saturday or a Sunday. And one of the things that my previous boss used to do was set the delivery date and time so that if he chose to work a weekend, I didn't then feel that I had to respond. So he would send everything to be delivered on a Monday morning at 9 o'clock or whatever time he chose. And it's worth thinking about that. You may want to work at the weekend because that suits you. You might want to work at 11 o'clock at night. But if you've got people that you feel will get stressed by receiving things and feel they've got to respond, think about setting a delivery time or date so that they aren't troubled by it. And the last thing that I would say, and it does link in with something that Peter's already said, I'm part of a relatively small team, and both my boss and one of the team members are new to the bank in the past year. We've met each other face to face once, and it's been incredibly difficult for those people to come in and become part of the team. And we've spent a lot of time making sure that we have sociable calls. So instead of it being all transactional, instead of having a team meeting that runs for half an hour and you talk about what business you're working on, you have a team meeting that lasts for 45 minutes and you hear about how people's families and dogs and kittens and, you know, all the important things. And I think we really need to prioritise that. Nobody would have thought anything of somebody going to the water cooler, the coffee shop, whatever, and taking 10 minutes to have a chat. Mm-hmm. But there's been a lot of pressure on us all to be tied to our desks the whole time, to be available when somebody rings, to be available for that video conference. So prioritise some time to be sociable, because you would have had it in the office. There's no reason why you shouldn't have it when you're working at home.
Such a good point, actually. And it, as we were saying earlier, I mean, it almost comes back, doesn't it? This has to be ingrained in the culture of the company. As we were saying earlier, Peter, at the very start of the call, that it has to come from the top, so that it is just accepting, you know, this is how you work. You are allowed breakouts. You need to have time away. You're not chained to your desk, as you say, Claire.
Yeah.
You're expected to go and get coffee. Otherwise, the rest of the team moan at you. But when you went to get the coffees, you would also have two or three several useful connections. And I think the first 3 or 4 months of lockdown in particular, a lot of those connections got lost. And we really need to take that time and make the effort to reconnect.
Yeah, and there are the times as well that when you can ask, you know, the little questions, how do I do that? You know, that, which you don't really want to put on an email, because you might, you know, that fear of being sounding silly if you're a more junior member of staff who's just new into a team. It's those little moments that we're losing then, isn't it?
I think it's the junior members of staff. I mean, I'm at the other end of my career. Yeah. But a lot of the successes that I've had in my career have come entirely from having flappy ears and hearing what is going on around me and learning from that. And it really worries me that people starting out in their career at the moment are completely losing the potential to hear how other people address things, to hear what's going on. It's just part and parcel of building your networks and being successful in business.
Yeah. I've got a good question here. It'd be quite a good one actually to end on. If we have the support at the top and people are sharing their stories, what else can we do to break down the stigma around mental health?
Well, to be honest with you, if you got that, you're doing pretty well. I guess there's a couple of things. I do think that it's not just about support at the top. I do think, and we're trying to do Let's Talk About sessions at work, when we talk about different elements, and we've had them about cancer, about bereavement. But I think it's really important for senior people to say, you know, hands up, I've had problems. I've suffered with depression or sleep issues or anxiety. And I think that vulnerability at the very top level, at board level, I think people think vulnerability is a weakness. It's not. Actually, vulnerability is strength if it's not, depending on how it's delivered. So I think humility is a very, I mean, I say it, I'm not just saying it because he's our CEO. I actually think Bill Winters, our CEO, is very good at humility. He's very good at self-deprecation. And I don't think there's enough of that. And I think it makes him a much more authentic and respected leader.
Well, it makes you more human.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, and I think that's really important. But also I think we need to give our managers the tools. I don't think we always do. And the tools are there, you know, Samaritans, mental health first aid. I mean, I'd like to, you know, some companies have a policy whereby all line managers have to have done mental health first aid training. I don't think that's a bad idea. And it's mandatory. because as I said, it did help me understand more about myself and about how to listen and understand people. But it wasn't just about work. You know, I'm not a mental health first aider where it only applies to work. I've used it with friends and acquaintances come to me outside of work that I've been able to talk to, and I've understood a bit more how to listen. Because as Claire says, it's not about solving things. It's about, a lot of the time, people get a great deal of relief just by the ability to offload and to talk. It's very cathartic and it's very releasing. And people will say, oh, I feel better just for being able to tell you that. I was holding that in, but off. I just feel better for having shared that with you. And sometimes for some people, that's enough. The sharing is enough to move them along on the journey. So I guess it's all of those things is how we break the stigmas down. I think we're in a good place in the West, in the UK, Europe, Americas. We still operate in parts of the world where it's harder. We operate in parts of the world, countries where they report zero suicides a year. They don't recognise suicide. Those countries are going to be difficult. Those countries are, you know, further back in terms of their journey. But that will move over time. I'm sure it will. As it does in all sorts of aspects. I do think we're in a better place. And I think it's, you know, I also think we've seen role models, you know, the royals talking about mental health. I think role models in society and to say, look, we all have mental health. This is the thing people forget. We all have mental health. Just sometimes, some of us, and often it's, now they say 1 in 4. I don't believe that stat. I think it's much more than that. I think many people have mental health issues at some stage in their lives. And so it's recognising that and saying it's not unusual. And also it doesn't stop you being high functioning and high performing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there needs to be an awareness around it.
Exactly.
And communicating that so that the vulnerability, whatever it is, it's all, that's okay. That just becomes, that's how it is.
Exactly. Yeah.
I had one of my old clients was a CEO moving into consulting out of banking, and he just couldn't find his feet in this new company, really struggled. And we talked about vulnerability, and he said, oh, I just really struggle with that. I don't want to go in and, you know, it's a sign of weakness. And weirdly, the week later, he broke his leg and he went in on crutches. And that was the pivot for him. Everyone sort of became much more open to him. And it was because of the, you know, everybody went, oh my God, he's actually just a human being. You know, he's broken his leg. And it's just having that vulnerability, even though he didn't necessarily want it, he saw the power of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's important that analogy as well is that we shouldn't see a broken leg any different to someone who's having a mental illness.
Absolutely.
It's the same. It's just, you know, and I've always said this, you know, if someone's broken their arm and can't type as quickly, you make allowances. And you understand that they're struggling. Why should it be different if someone's having a mental health crisis or they're suffering with anxiety or they've got a particularly difficult period of stress? Why should it be any different?
Yeah. And it's great that we've moved away from the automatic, oh, just take some time off. You're signed off, 2 weeks signed off. It's great that there's so many more tools out there that we can access.
Yeah. I agree.
Claire, have you any last, because we're coming up to the hour?
The only thing I would say based on what you've just said is that I would always stress the prevention being better than a cure.
Absolutely.
And I always say to people, you know, it's better to perhaps take 1 week out now than wait till you fall off a cliff and you need 3 months to recover your mental health. And there are so many resources in most organisations, whether it's the employee assistance programmes that a lot of large organisations offer. Pete's mentioned the Samaritans a number of times. There's all sorts of resources that are available. If you feel that your mental health is suffering in any way, treat it quickly in the same that you would way you would a physical illness. Don't wait till you fall off that cliff.
This is very good words of advice. Peter, I'm going to leave you the last few words.
No, I think that's something I will. Thank you, everyone that's joined the call. It's been, again, I enjoy doing these. I enjoy talking about mental health and, you know, just want to get that message out more and more. And thank you for Armstrong Wolf for arranging it. And this week, this is Mental Health Awareness Week. Let's do all and individually and collectively to be more aware around mental health and to be more human.
Absolutely. Well, I think we are coming up to the hour. I really do want to thank each and every one of you for attending today's session on how to support and retain engagement when second and third degrees of contact are lost. I hope you've taken away some little tips. I certainly have. I love the virtual commute, because actually that could be a good time to do a little bit of exercise, which is seriously lacking at the minute. So some wonderful tips for me. And I hope you can take away something. A huge thank you, Peter, and to Claire. What a wonderful open session. And thank you, Charlotte and Holly in the background, as always, putting everything together. So can I just ask you also, please, more than feel free to contact us with any feedback you have. We would love to know, because we want to be of service to you, because you really all deserve it. And I wish you all a wonderful rest of the day. And thank you again so very much. Thanks, Peter. Thanks, Claire. Bye.
Thank you, everyone. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.